This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
It's a wonderful place to start to taste the Tathagata's words. It's said that the Lankavatara Sutra, in its most simplified form, and some of you have read it, there's not a very simplified form. It's to make a cup of tea and taste it. So a wonderful environment to start. My teacher, Sokazan, one time said to me after I'd given a Dharma talk, this was a number of years ago, he said, "Do you know what the difference between the two of us is?" And some of you are smiling because you know it's a trap. It's a setup. Being the good student, Hojo-sama, what is the difference between the two of us? He said, "I know I'm a fool. You're still trying not to be one." How could one not be a fool talking about the Lankavatara Sutra? I will do my best. I've been studying this for about 10 years. With Sokazan and with the community at Sokakoji, we study this right now every Monday night. I think at one point we were studying it 5 days a week. But to give you a little bit of history on this particular text, this is considered one of the foundational texts of Zen Buddhism. And it has a heavy history, it has a lot of weight behind it, that historically speaking, everyone's going to argue about who wrote what and when it was written, and you've all heard that story. But it's said that the original manuscripts were in classical Sanskrit, meaning that while some scholars say Zen originated in China, that it's very likely that Bodhidharma actually was practicing Zen in India and brought it to China. And on meeting his Dharma heir, Hui Ko, some of us know the story of Hui Ko's intensity, chopping his arm off, showing Bodhidharma he was a true vessel for the Dharma. Bodhidharma handed him the Lankavatara Sutra and said, "Everything you need to know about Zen is in this text." We study a lot at Sokakoji, about 12 times a week, for an hour and 15 to an hour and a half at a time. And I would like to invite you into a different understanding of study. This is what we hear on refrain. It is important to study. It is not important to understand. Do not need to be a scholar to see the truth. It is intimate and beyond concepts. And so today, during this talk, I would ask you to contemplate some questions. This is a little bit of the Sokakoji flavor. I'll talk for 10, 15, 20 minutes, talk a little bit about the sutra, and then I'd like to respond to your questions about that. And I'm going to read a few lines from the Lankavatara Sutra. That particularly stand out to me. And I'm not a very scholastic monk. Sitting is my preferred expression of the Dharma. When I moved into Sokakoji, I was 23 years old. And I went from sitting 30 minutes a day to 6.5 hours a day, 30 hours a week for about 7 years until our son was born. And now we scrape by with 10 or 15 hours a week. So this is why I want to talk a little bit about questions to begin. And this is the Buddha responding to Mahamati. So the Buddha was asked to answer questions. Mahamati is the bodhisattva in this text that allows the Buddha to draw out the teachings. He asks the questions. And the Buddha says, "Excellent, Mahamati, it is excellent that upon considering the true nature of the world and hoping to awaken beings of the past, the present, and the future from mistaken views, you have asked me about this. For a wise person should ask questions, not only for their own benefit, but also for the benefit of others. The Bodhisattva activity that penetrates all the sutras, starting with the Buddha's first discourse, is somebody asking for the Dharma. And it's so hard. It's so hard to ask for the Dharma. It's vulnerable. You know what's scary about asking for the Dharma? You might be taught. That's uncomfortable. So oftentimes we try to soften our questions. First, we'll tell the teacher 5 things we know, and then we ask the question. Or we say, is it this right? Do I got this right? Or is it this or is it this? So really, we want the teacher to be a little tiny person that reassures us of our understanding. I talked to Doug a little bit about this. This is what I've been personally studying lately. And Doug told me he's been studying this for how many years? You stumbled upon this ages ago, probably before I was practicing the Dharma. But this is Thomas Cleary's translation of some of the earliest Chan masters of the Tang and Song dynasty. So we're 7th to 12th century, the heart or the height of classical Chinese Buddhism. And this is Fo Yan, and he says, if you don't ask, you won't get it. But if you ask, in effect, you've slighted yourself. If you don't ask, how can you know? But you still have to know how to ask before you can succeed. So it's a practice asking for the Dharma. It's a practice that we refine being open, having a willingness to see the areas we don't particularly want to see, to begin to loosen our hold on our understanding or our beliefs about the Dharma. So that's my little preface to begin. But what I really wanted to talk about, and this is to me the heart of Zen. The heart of Zen is not doctrine, it's not institutions, it's not formality, it is the intimate transmission of the mind seal. It is personal realization outside of any context. So any context can be used. So here's Mahamati asking the Buddha, Bhagwan, why is speech said to be eternal? The Buddha told Mahamati, because of delusion. Delusions also appear to the wise, but they aren't confused by them. Delusions also appear to the wise, but they aren't confused by them. So when we touch on the heart of this teaching, personal realization, the intimate realization, our impulse is to look somewhere else. But the Buddha says, an enlightened being is just not confused by what arises. And while sometimes it's the simplest thing we return to, the seated practice of meditation, it's good to hear that reminder. Meditation is not a state. Meditation is not a creation. Meditation is not something that should be held in opposition to somewhere else. Meditation is when we sit down and take our seat and have a willingness to receive all of our senses as they arise. All of our insanity, all of our clarity, all of our neuroticism, all of our kindness. And whatever arises, that's what we're practicing. Receiving the mind, receiving things precisely as they are, not searching for something different. The truth is to be seen in everything. I believe it was Dogen that said, everything is constantly preaching the Dharma. So that's where we start. That's what we're doing together this 5 days, is we're going to sit a lot. And it's going to get more difficult. For any of you that have sat Sesshin, you know it's going to get more difficult. More reasons to get up. I've got to take care of something. I really should see if they need any help. More reasons to move, more reasons not to come back. But that very aspect of the mind that does not feel like enlightenment is our invitation to see the truth. So that as we practice here, this isn't a separate situation from what we return to when we go home, that we begin to cultivate that attitude of receiving the world as it arises. We begin to take responsibility for everything, the bodhisattva path. May all beings be happy and at their ease. May all beings awaken before me. May I serve all beings. May I liberate all beings. However you put it, it's a radical path. And so we start with our own mind. We don't immediately jump to the external world and take our confusion out into the world and say, hey, here's my ideas. Why don't you do that too? First, we become clear about what's happening here. And it's not easy taking responsibility because the idealism around the bodhisattva path is really beautiful, right? It's beautiful to think about how we might someday receive all beings. It's very difficult to refuse the person that offends you. It's very difficult to receive the person that cuts you off. And so what I'd like to return to with the Lankavatara Sutra is the idea that everything that arises, without exception, no matter how much relative evidence you have to support your story, is your responsibility. It is your mind. And Sokazan often says, nobody can dump a bucket of emotions into you. The evidence, yes, in a court of law, you win. You are correct. Perfect. But it is still our responsibility to receive that. And until we're able to do that in a radical form, and until we're able to receive the most apparent slight as ours, as ours, as ours, receive, we continue to struggle with the world. So we continue to return to the cushion. There's one more passage I wanted to read to you. It's again the Buddha teaching, expounding to Mahamati. Furthermore, Mahamati, Shravakas who are afraid of the suffering that comes from the projection of samsara, Shravakas who are afraid of the projections that come from samsara, seek nirvana, unaware that the difference between samsara and nirvana, as well as the projection of everything else, does not exist. So the Lankavatara is encouraging us. There's nothing to search for. Our distinction between samsara and nirvana, perhaps it's inspiring. Brings us back to the cushion. Life is suffering. Buddha's first teaching, life is suffering. But the Buddha says, the projection of everything else does not exist. So a radical form of reception. And this is, to me, the embodiment of Zen, regardless of what form it takes, what clothes you put on, what kind of space you practice in, kind of books you study, is this radical invitation to begin to receive everything that arises without a reference point in that terrifying space, at least terrifying to ego, where there's nothing that lasts. There's nothing to lean on indefinitely. We have supports on the path, but in the end, we have to make the tea and then we have to taste it. The image is kind of great. It's kind of a really funny image if you think about it. Can you imagine someone coming to you and saying, oh my gosh, I found the greatest recipe for paella. It's incredible. Well, how was it? I don't know. I didn't make it. I haven't tried it yet. So we study, but we don't have to understand. We bring our attention to these profound teachings. And sometimes they make sense. Sometimes they feel supportive. And other times they're frustrating. And it's all a part of the mind to be received. So perhaps later in the week, we'll talk about some of the frustrating things, the three modes of reality. What is that? The Trisvabhava, the three own beings. Good luck.
Was that your teacher that said good luck, Dean? Yeah, good luck. The eight consciousnesses, the Yogacara school, further elaboration on the five skandhas, five dharmas. But in the end, whatever shows up in the context of this retreat, in the context of our practice, in the context of our world, whether formally or informally, we're relating to the bodhisattva path. If you've not formally taken the vow, it's not a problem, but you're here. You're here. You're training your mind for the benefit of all beings. So in as far as we can, let's try to receive it. So I'd like some questions if there are any. To use them.
Use the mind. What does confusion with what's arising look like in the mind stream or in functioning?
What does it look like? To the untrained mind, it looks like hope and fear. It looks like there's something to hold on to and something to reject. As we begin to train the mind, we just see texture. We see contrast. And it's not that the impulse is not there. It's not that preferences have completely dissolved. And I think that's a distinction that there's argument within Buddhism. If we look at the early Theravadins, Nirodha is the word for extinction. There's no longer any defilements. But as I understand it, to be clear about the confusion allows us to function in such a way that we're not functioning out of the confusion. The anger is still there. The frustration, the anxiety, the depression, the fear. But the storyline doesn't hook up in such a way where that is how we function. We actually have the consideration for everything that is arising in front of us. Mike?
Yeah, it's just kind of a general question. When I look at these ancient texts, I understand Buddhism's a way to end suffering. How do we bring this into today to help end suffering, human need? How do we bring this into today's context? How is this going to not say end poverty, just how is this going to make the world a better place, or just make us better in the world?
Wonderful question. And the disappointing thing is it's not some immediate type of a magical wand where you get to touch people and all their problems are gone. But if we are not clear about our confusion, we continue to project that into the world. Other things Sokazan has said to me before, as long as you're not clear about your own personal warfare that's raging inside of you, you will continue to turn that weapon on others. Mm-hmm. So clarify the mind. Wei Ning said, if somebody is ready, teach them the Dharma. If not, just be kind. Just be kind. Listen, receive, ask questions, ask questions, ask questions. Do not give advice. Do not interrupt somebody's confusion for your ideas. Sometimes the best thing somebody can do is be confused and left alone. And other times it's not the case. The Buddha's teachings can't be applied uniformly in all situations. The Buddha, through all the sutras, continues to tell his disciples, I teach to the capacity of those in front of me. That's not lesser and greater capacity. It's what do you need? The most profound teacher is not the one that can articulate the clearest, but the one that can meet you where you're at, can meet you in your confusion. You don't have to go up to the mountaintop. The teacher comes to you, meets you right in the muck. I'm really working on names, so give me a minute. Don.
You're doing great.
Thank you.
Better than me. So I don't want to get ahead. Here is the student trying to soften the teacher. And this could be an introduction to another 5 days. Okay. But here goes. This isn't getting any easier for me.
And good.
I'm coming to kind of a vantage point where I see the noise and the disquietude of the mind, the roaring stream of thoughts coming in, and I have some conceptual understanding of receiving that. But the question is, what's your best advice about how to receive it. And Mike, I think, dovetailed a little bit on that. But mm-hmm. yeah, and obviously the cushion, probably 99% of it. But
I appreciate you bringing that up, because sometimes the idealism around meditation is that it should be a progressing out of suffering, that every day we feel less and less miserable. And unfortunately, sometimes it's the opposite. We start to go down. The image I think of is that you've spent decades, lifetimes, I don't know, creating barriers and ways to soften our negativity. As we practice, those tools for mitigation become weaker. We begin to feel more intimately. And I would encourage you, as my teacher has encouraged me, is to just keep going and to feel deeply. You do not need to understand. You do not need to put the feelings into context. That feeling is enough. That feeling is enough. And it's disappointing. And I don't know if this is true. I've really been lucky to meet a lot of people who've been practicing for a very long time. My teacher for 50 years with two powerful teachers. And this is something that was quoted to Kobenchino Roshi, but I make no claims having not heard it myself, was that if you think the first 10 years are difficult, wait for the second 10. Mm-hmm. Regardless of who said it, though, is that we're going to have to see suffering very clearly. And I think that is what a bodhisattva is, one that has the willingness to feel that. Because if you extinguish suffering in such a way where you just always feel very good and chipper and cheerful, all you can tell people is to get rid of their suffering. But to actually know that you can be completely present in this world of samsara, but you also don't need to be driven by it. But in order to do that, we have to feel the suffering. We have to feel that. And I like that word texture. See if you can go into the texture. You don't necessarily conceptualize it too much. That may happen spontaneously. And if it does, don't stop that. Don't stop that. But if you can, just flash on the texture, flash on the tightness, flash on the heat, flash on the discomfort. Thank you. Wait. I don't think this one's going to come to me.
Ross,
thank you.
Yeah, I had a question about responsibility. Because it seems like there's two aspects of it. One is that, for example, say I get upset, I can recognize that this is something that I'm creating. But it seems like for me, if I feel like I'm responsible for not being upset or to be mature, then that it's almost like me trying to, you know, more me. And in a way, it feels like, is there a way I can receive something so that I can see that upset and not, you know, not be attached to it, but almost like there's something where I receive it rather than try to not be that.
But whatever is arising is already complete. It's already perfect. So you don't need to try not to be attached to it. My encouragement is to see the attachment. I think sometimes that's what the practice is. It sets up standards or teachings that we know we can't quite do. So all you have to do is just see that. Notice when it becomes what could be called and what has been called an outflow. When it becomes, when you hook up the vocal cords, when you hook up the musculature and extend it outward. So it's not a matter of controlling or confining your activity, but being very clear and seeing if you can't see it. It starts out as just a little heat in the gut. See if you can see it there before it erupts. And I really hope that you feel encouraged and that you are encouraged that, as I understand it, you're not endeavoring to create a meditator. You do not need to create an artificial facade. The awareness itself will help direct the activity, but it takes time. It's not an instantaneous thing. It's not a matter of 5 years or 10 years, unless you're
like waiting in and you just lucky you hear one line of the Vajra Chetaka and it's like, oh yeah, that sounds good. Go pound rice with homegrown. So continue. But it gets more difficult. May I ask who is your teacher?
Oh, no.
Listen to Doug. No. That's a good thing to do. Sometimes when you're not sure what to do, that's the best place to return is the teacher. Return to the teacher. And try not to be too autobiographical in my teaching. But I just want to give you an example. I've been at the monastery for a long time. And as I said, I moved in when I was very young. And within the first year, I became my teacher's student. 23 years old. Is anyone here under 30? So a 23-year-old, and there wasn't anyone under 40 at Soka Koshi. And it was difficult. And I remember one day having an interview with somebody. And we have interviews with one another, and we just bowed. It's a way of formalizing our communication. And they said, I just want you to know, Chie-san, that everything you do arises out of hatred and envy. And I was heartbroken, you know. You extend yourself and you do. And of course I'm crazy. Of course I've got edges and they spark here and there. And I brought it to Sokazan and he said, why didn't you thank him? Why didn't you thank him? To go to war with confusion only breeds confusion. So sometimes the best thing we can do, thank you. I will consider that. I appreciate your directness. Instead of, well, don't you know what I do? It is a radical path. It is difficult. And we are doing it every moment. Boss. Work on it. For the questions. Since you always ask me the hardest questions.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure.
Good. We're both nervous.
In that example you just gave of Sokazan asking, why didn't you thank him?
Mm-hmm.
If something like that shows up when we're being accused of something, or being called something, and we thank that person, do we have to mean it?
No. And you might not, and that's important. Do not become an artificial thanker above everybody. Very simply, it might be, well, oh no, I think we misunderstood. And then it's like, oh yeah, okay, I see what you mean. And other times that's all you can do. So it's always situational. It's always situational. And even a spark of you could be grateful because, again, the intensity that arose at how hurt I was. Still, there's something there for me to see, for me to receive, for me to look at. What am I still holding on to as far as what I think is right and wrong? How people should and should not function? It's difficult. I think Sesshin at Soka Koji, every year it's like kind of this catchphrase, Sesshin's a pressure cooker. It's like a pressure cooker. And it's so easy when nothing is happening to get irritated how people relate to forms. Nothing's happening. Somebody sniffled too loud. Somebody stomped on the deck. Somebody was late to sitting. Nothing to do with you. It's incredible how personal it becomes. So just endeavor to give it our attention. Wait. Starts with a C.
Yeah.
Colin?
Curtis.
Wondering what your experience has been in relationship to a teacher when the back and forth can seem like so like roundabout and like almost ridiculous sometimes.
I'm full of these phrases. I'm really glad Shoho Mike's here. Shoho Sama. He can report back to, as he calls it, my boss. Tell me. If you don't know what you need to learn, this is what was told to me. If you don't know what you need to learn, everything is a teaching. So the roundaboutness is thinking that you're going to get somewhere. We're going in circles, but we should be getting somewhere. What is arising is where you're getting. It's just this.
And for me personally, and I think it's important for those of you that have teachers or consider someone your teacher, you don't need to believe anything I say. And if it's contrary to what your teacher says, I would prioritize what your teacher says. For me, it has been incredibly important to have a very strong relationship with my teacher. It took a lot of time. Really, really didn't like Soka Zan when I met him. Really didn't like him. Very hard for me to give somebody the authority or recognize someone who may have insight into this. But once you ask somebody to be your teacher, and I would discourage you from doing that unless you absolutely have to. It's not casual. In as far as you can, give them the benefit of the doubt. In as far as you can, receive as much as possible. The nature of that relationship is threatening. And I do not mean in a dangerous way, but I mean the very nature of the path is to question our belief in self and other. And how can a teacher help you see that if they don't hurt your feelings sometimes? Do something that is provocative. But hopefully, there's always the ability to communicate with the teacher. It's not complete, unintelligent obeisance. So return to your teacher over and over and over. Return to your teacher, expose yourself, be vulnerable with the teacher, and don't demand anything as far as how you should be responded to, because the very sensitivity we feel in a way is exactly what the teacher is helping us to see. Joe Kangpa Rinpoche said, the job of the teacher is to insult the student. Mm-hmm. Maybe not always, because the teacher also can be the embodiment of compassion and love and softness and refuge. But sometimes they're going to have to irritate you. Colin, more on that?
Jizan. I think you mentioned realization being beyond concepts, and you talked about study. And so I wonder what the function of studying concepts is if realization is beyond concept.
I think it brings our attention, our awareness to the intellectual part of the mind. And I think the best place to study, as we do at Soka Koji, is with a group of people, because it's so easy to pick up by the Lanka, like the Lanka, do this. I've read the Lanka. Yeah, I read it. I really liked it. It's really great. It's very helpful. You study it with a group of people, and they start saying things that are different than what you think. So it's an aspect of Sangha. It's something that's emphasized at Soka Koji heavily. Sangha, Sangha, Sangha. The most difficult of the three jewels. The most challenging and frustrating of the three jewels. So we come together as a group and we study this material, and it takes a long time. I would say it takes us a few years to get through the Lanka one time. I think in the 10 years, we've been through it four times. It's a slow process. Ekudo.
How does one choose what to study?
Who is your teacher, if I might ask?
Paula Jones.
And are you in touch with her?
Yes.
Ask her what to study. What should I be studying? Because isn't that terrifying how many Dharma books are out there?
Yeah. It is.
And not to, you know, to be a little bit funny, how many of them are about only good for paperweights? Hold things down. Everyone's trying to sell something. So I would say, ask the teacher, you know. I don't know how you address her, Paula-sama. What, you know, what would be something that would be helpful for you to study? Are there other questions this afternoon about anything in regards to what we've talked about in the Lankavatara Sutra?
I think the Kwayan quote was, if you ask the question, you slight yourself. Mm. What is he pointing at with that?
Just looking at how we're searching externally. It's not to stop that. It is not to stop the inquiry, but it's to
bring attention to that nobody can give you this. It's not created, it's not dependently arisen, it's not incomplete. But at the same time, we really need the support of the forms. We need the support of the teacher, the three jewels. So just to be aware that when you ask a question and you don't get a satisfying answer, it's because there's nothing that's going to satisfy you fundamentally that can be presented in words. Was missing some things. I'll give you one more. The Buddha replied, Mahamati, words are not ultimate truth, nor is what they express ultimate truth. And how so? Ultimate truth is what Buddhas delight in, and what words lead to is ultimate truth, but words are not ultimate truth. Ultimate truth is what is attained by the personal realization of Buddha knowledge. It is not a realm known by means of the projection of words. Therefore, the projection of words does not express ultimate truth. Not to do away with words, not to do away with all the sutras and the scriptures and the commentaries, but to recognize that what words are endeavoring to point at is the truth, not the words themselves. And I feel that that's a lot of where sectarianism comes from, this belief that I have the true path, you don't have the true path, we have the true. The fly on my face. Is the belief we get so infatuated with our ideas. There's no humor. There's no humor at all. It doesn't mean it's funny. It just means a willingness to move, a willingness to be fluid with what is arising. You could actually enjoy or appreciate somebody's insanity for a little bit. Yes, Peter.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm down here in Santa Cruz, and thank you for your teaching up there at Jikoji. I'm sitting here with a friend named David, and he has a question.
Yes, David. Oh, you froze up.
That even those who are enlightened have delusion come up, they can deal with it, and how we have to be able to receive all things. One thing that I think we're all somewhat suffering with is the influence of all the media. I'm not going to go into all of that, but there's an awful lot of confusion. And when we have a conscience about things, it's inevitable to have a lot of pain just considering things. I'm wondering if you have some guidance about, as we're surrounded by all sorts of messaging and so forth, because we don't want to be ignorant, but we don't want to be pulled under. So any general type of guidance would be appreciated.
I would say limit it, create a form. Just we have a form for meditation, create a form. How often are you going to check the news? How much are you going to watch the news? You're right, I think it's important that we know what's happening. But you can become so consumed that it's terrible, devastating. So limit it a little bit. And then the other suggestion, which won't surprise anybody, would be to train your mind to receive without the elaboration, without the addition, or noticing the perpetual addition that arises spontaneously.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mike?
Just quickly, you were saying that.
You can go slowly too if you want.
Okay.
It's up to you.
I moved out of there and I moved them up in Lakewood. Okay. And what's called Trump country, you know. But the thing is, I know on a very deep level, those people are me and I'm them. And, you know, I'm really, really sick of hearing how different, you know, all that. But still, I mean, I know that they're me and I'm them and they're Buddhas. Sometimes I just really despise them, but I can't hate them because, you know, I understand where they're coming from. I just, and the homeless and the drug and everything that's increasing where I live, it's remarkable to see. It's just trying to keep and even keel and all of that, and try to see the humanness. And not, even though, you know, sometimes they're scary, you know, people scare you. And sometimes I hate them, but then when I hate them, I, you know, it somehow clouds me.
Mm.
I don't know where I actually am going. I just like trying to, sometimes it's hopelessly confused. And I don't know what to do. Like, I walk in the park every day with all these people, they're on a place to live. You're homeless, you know, or whatever, drug addicted. And I get so sick of them, you know, and I'm like, you know, I was that way when I was a kid, you know. And it's just hard to deal with all that all the time. And see their humanness and stay a somewhat kindness for them, you know, and for myself, because I'm not unkind to them, I'm kind to me on a fundamental level, I think. I don't know. I'm just confused.
You're in good company.
Not again to be particularly satisfying, but the advantage of being aware of prejudice is profound, because everyone has prejudice. Everyone has that. But it's when you're not aware of it that you function out of it as if it were true. It's not a matter of beating yourself up, but go into that a little bit. See if you can feel, what is that? What is that? And don't look for an answer necessarily. Just that attitude. What is that? That's enough. It's enough to ask the question. I know you didn't ask me a question, but I'm responding anyway. Thank you for sharing that. Any other questions this afternoon? I don't know where we are for time. Hey, Kudo.
So I find it very difficult to come up with questions. I do.
Yeah.
I'm busy taking everything in, but questions don't come out.
Yeah.
What do you say to me?
That's okay.
Okay.
That's okay. You just asked me a question.
I know.
Wait, I wanna see if Shoho Sama wants to get at me a little bit before we close. Hey, you're muted, Shoho.
Thank you for your teachings. Thank you for coming here so much on behalf of everyone. And Jikoji, thank you so much for teaching us this week. Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for the transmission of this lineage, for allowing this teaching to, oh, it's incredibly moving to me. Thank you. I appreciate everyone's questions and your willingness to entertain this style of talk. And it means a tremendous amount to be. I told Shoho the first time I showed up here, it's strange to be somewhere brand new and so incredibly familiar. And I don't mean the practice or the forms. It was something. I'd been to a few other centers in California last spring, and coming to where Coven very clearly is still present. Our lineage holders are very much present. A precious gift to stumble into something so genuine.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.